I'm Michelle Martin, and this is Tell Me More from NPR News. We're talking about the effects of those across-the-board budget cuts caused by the sequester. We've been particularly interested in education, and today we're going to hear about the effect on Head Start. That's a program that helps low-income kids get ready for school. That conversation is later in the program. First, though, we want to talk about a related issue, which is how the effects of the most recent recession are dragging on and on, especially for people of color. According to a new report by the Urban Institute, Hispanic families lost 44% of their wealth between 2007 and 2010. African American families lost 31% of their wealth in that time, and that compares to an 11% decline for whites. Much of those losses can be traced to the collapse of the housing market, and many public policy analysts argue that avoiding another bubble means tightening the standards for lending. But our next guest says that's exactly the wrong approach. Jim Carr is a housing and urban policy expert with the Opportunity Agenda. That's a progressive think tank, but he's been studying housing and housing finance for more than 30 years, and he's with us now from St. Louis Public Radio. Jim Carr, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you, Michelle.
Before we get to your solution, I want to look more closely at the problem. Why is it that the housing crash seemed to affect people of color so profoundly? Why are these groups hit so hard?
What was happening in the housing market was an experiment in unregulated markets in which lenders were peddling loans that were literally designed to fail. And when you say that, a lot of people say, well, no one would design a loan to fail, but they did. They designed loans to trigger unaffordable payments so that the borrowers would be forced to come back to the table in another 3 years and refinance. And with that refinance, they got lots of fees collected. And they were able to do that as long as house prices were rising, because effectively what the lenders were doing was just taking away the accumulated housing equity and starting that game all over again. Elizabeth Warren, who led the charge for Consumer Financial Protection Bureau and is now a senator, actually coined those mortgages exploding mortgages.
Were these groups more vulnerable because they were first-time home buyers, or were they specifically targeted, in your opinion, for this? I think a lot of people would ask, you know, why would these particular groups be particularly vulnerable to them?
These lenders targeted people of color, particularly African Americans and Hispanics, knowing that they were less familiar with how the mortgage finance system worked, and took advantage of their lack of information. A lot of people say, well, no, the foreclosure crisis was a failed government experiment in, trying to expand home ownership to people who couldn't afford it. But less than 10% of those subprime loans that were the epicenter of the foreclosure crisis were for first-time home ownership. This was a refinancing game, and it was refinancing aimed directly at people of color.
This has been something that's been argued rather sort of intensely over the last couple of years as this crisis, if we could use that word, has kind of dragged on and on. There were those who argued that this was overreach by home buyers, people whose, as my mother would say, whose eyes were bigger than their stomachs, who were buying too much house with too little money and were irresponsible or didn't take the time to be well informed. I mean, what would you say about that?
We've had more than 12 million foreclosure filings since 2007. So within that, certainly there were some people who got in and, you know, were speculating and they got burned. But to go from housing being the safest, most reliable asset for nearly half a century, and then all of a sudden to just instantly have this foreclosure crisis, it wasn't a change in mentality of the American public, you know, and all of a sudden people becoming irresponsible and reckless. It was a change in the types of mortgage products that were being offered and a failure by federal regulatory agencies to purge those products. It was not only predictable, Michelle, it was predicted by many research organizations, including the one that I'm affiliated with. So there was no surprise when this foreclosure crisis came. Everyone had been talking about it for more than a decade leading up to it. And Michelle, I'll just give you one point of reference. The state of North Carolina was dealing with this issue so significantly that way back in 1999, they passed a statewide law to ban these loans. And the federal government set that law aside to allow, you know, basically saying that federal law in this case was the predominant law, and those loans just continued.
If you're just joining us, we're talking about the loss of wealth, particularly among people of color, since the collapse of the housing market. Our guest is economic analyst Jim Carr. We've been talking about the roots of the issue. Now, Jim Carr, you have a very different perspective on the way to address this. As we know that, you know, policy seems to be moving toward tightening lending standards. Do you say that that's the wrong approach?
Absolutely, because low down payments and credit scores did not cause this crisis. It was reckless, irresponsible lending of loans that were never designed to succeed. Use the credit score as an example. The Federal Reserve Board itself estimated that in 2006, more than 60% of the borrowers in the subprime market, which was that failed market, more than 60% had credit scores eligible for a prime loan. So this wasn't about low credit scores and it wasn't about low down payments. We have a history of sustainable loan down payments. It was reckless lending. And so what we need to do now is we need to better regulate the markets. And we've taken a good step in that direction with the establishment of the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau. But we need not to sort of forget what happened. Low down payment mortgages are really an important tool in the mortgage market. They didn't cause the collapse, and we need to get back to it, as well as recognizing that not everybody has a high credit score, but a lower credit score does not mean you're not capable of managing a loan. It simply means that you manage your finances differently, maybe not as well as some others, but there's a difference in you're not perfect at managing your finances versus you're irresponsible for home ownership.
Obviously, the predicate of your point here is that wealth needs to be rebuilt through housing because that is the way that most middle-class people build their wealth. So what would a credit structure look like that would do that without creating another disaster?
When you're doing underwriting, for example, underwriting is complicated. And so when you look at what are the contributors to a loan defaulting, you have your credit history is important, your down payment is important, but the loan product type is more important than either of those. So if you have a loan, for example, that's adjusting upward every single year, clearly, just intuitively, you know that's a more dangerous loan that is fixed over a period of 30 years. Your debt-to-income ratio is important, et cetera. So my point is that you don't focus on one thing like a credit score or a down payment in isolation. You look at the full characteristics of that loan, and you put a responsible loan in place. And we have, you know, we've known for years what constitutes a good, solid, underwritten loan. And low down payments are part of a good, well underwritten loan. Verifying the information, for example, from a consumer is really important. So all of these things are important and they have to be taken together.
Why housing, though? I mean, there are those who argue that this country in general is overly invested in housing, that we're just housing crazy. I bet you if you were to stop five kids on the street and say, what does the American dream look like? It would be a house. But there are people who argue that that's just the wrong mentality, that it kind of ties people to neighborhoods, it makes the labor market less fluid, that, you know, maybe we should just change our whole thinking about this. You disagree?
Totally, because housing is the single most important asset to the American family for some very powerful reasons. The first is which, you know, if you're investing in an alternative vehicle like the stock market, you're still going to have to pay rent. The beauty of a house is that you're able to invest in the place where you're living. And so you're owning, you're renting from yourself. That's the first most powerful thing. The second is that you're able to buy a house on high leverage. And with the right products, it's a safe high leverage. So, for example, if you're buying a home for $100,000 and you pay 10% down, you get the return on the full $100,000 value of that home. That's hard to beat. There is no comparable asset that most people can buy into that will allow them to actually pay their rent simultaneously with building income and at the same time have that high leverage. The idea that a housing locks you into a neighborhood, it's just, you know, a noise. The fact is that in a robust, healthy housing market, if you have to move, you will sell your home at a reasonable appreciated value and you will gain some wealth in the process. And if you're moving that quickly, you know, in next year or 2 years from now, you shouldn't be a homeowner. And the other thing, Michelle, is important. People should not be speculating on homes and buying more than they can afford. But my point is that we had almost 60 years of history to show housing is the most reliable, safest, and important investment for the typical American household. And I don't think that we should use a period of failed regulatory oversight to then all of a sudden start rethinking what has worked for more than half a century.
You've obviously pointed to a number of policy changes that would need to take place to put this into practice. short of that, is there anything that individuals can do now to try to address this?
It's time to fix the housing market because the housing market is broken. In terms of individuals, what they can do, they can be very assertive in looking for affordable homeownership opportunities. And remember that there is also FHA, which still does allow for low down payments and is more flexible with respect to its underwriting criteria, including credit history. I would say this is a good opportunity, particularly in the markets that have been depressed and are starting to come back, that individuals might want to look for home ownership opportunities.
And finally, before we let you go, why should people care about this?
They should care particularly on the race-ethnicity issue because, you know, we used to say, Michelle, that in another 40 years or so, America will be a country whose largest share of the population are people of color. But as of a couple of years ago, the largest number of babies born in America are now people of color. And so it's really important to have people of color being able to build wealth and to be viable players in the economy of America, because it's essential not just to those families, but it's essential to America's overall competitiveness in the future. And again, I just keep coming back to housing is that one asset that is equally shared across all American families, unlike the stock market, which is heavily and disproportionately held by the wealthy.
Jim Carr is a distinguished scholar at the Opportunity Agenda. He's a senior fellow at the Center for American Progress. We caught up with him in St. Louis at St. Louis Public Radio in St. Louis, Missouri. Jim Carr, thank you for speaking with us.
Thank you, Michelle.
I'm Michelle Martin, and this is Tell Me More from NPR News. We're going to spend some time now talking about early childhood education. President Obama called it a priority in this year's State of the Union address, so we want to talk about the state of early childhood education across the country. We'll hear more about that a bit later. But first, we want to talk about changes already happening to one important early child development program. We've talked before about those across-the-board budget cuts, which were crafted to reduce the federal deficit. They're known as the sequester. It turns out that the Head Start program is feeling the pain now in many places. That program, you may remember, is intended to help children from low-income families get the most out of school. Here's a clip of a mother, Ann Stover, from East Dallas, Texas, whose son, Rhett, lost his place in Head Start last month, along with hundreds of other children, because his program was closed down early because of budget cuts.
Head Start had a massive positive impact on him. He was able to vastly improve his vocabulary, his reading and writing skills, his social skills with other children. And the very first day of public school, the first observation his new teachers had was how articulate he was, how well-mannered he was, and what a grasp of language he had. And I know that that is a direct result of being in Head Start.
The White House estimates that because of these budget cuts known as the sequester, 70,000 children who would have been served by Head Start will not have access to the program by the end of the year. And as you just heard, that means that some programs have already shut down. We wanted to talk more about this, so joining us now is NPR's education correspondent Claudio Sanchez. Also with us, teacher Tabitha McMullen, who works at a Head Start in Salina, Kansas. Welcome to you both. Thank you both so much for joining us.
Good to be here.
Thank you.
Claudio, in your case, welcome back. Let me start with you. Why is Head Start being affected this way so early? I think a lot of people think of education funding as being advanced at the beginning of the school year, and it lasts through the school year, or at least throughout the year. So why is this happening now?
You're right, though. Education, public education that gets federal money, Michelle, gets a lot of forward-funded money. In other words, the money is put out there way before it kicks in, and let's say the fall, the money's already there for those schools opening up in the fall. Head Start is not like that. Head Start, for example, for many school systems, their fiscal year began in December. So what many of them have had to do is go back and say, well, now we're not going to count with this amount of money, meaning over 5%, a 5% budget cut. And they're realizing they're not going to have enough money to end the year. So they're having to go back and say, what can we cut? Not just enrollment, but staff, programs, hours, and that's the only way they're going to make it, because that's the only amount of money they have.
Tabitha, what happened in your area?
Well, our program, we were fortunate to be close to the end of our fiscal year, and we didn't have to close any classrooms down, but we did make some big cuts for the next year to our full-day, full-year classroom. We have three of those, which is basically the parents have to be either in school or working full-time, not completely full-time, but at least 20 hours a week to qualify for child care. And those classrooms have been cut and moved to regular nine-month classrooms. But other people in our area, like in Wichita, have been cut completely, shut down classrooms. People said, don't come to work the next day. You don't get paid. Your kids can't come to school.
What happened when you shared or when the administrator shared these changes with the families?
Oh, gosh. I was at the meeting when they shared this with the families, and I kind of heard slowly. We tried to prepare them for that. There was a lot of confusion, a lot of, why is this happening to us? We are working. We are gainfully employed. Now we don't have care for our children. What are we going to do? It was a lot of unsureness about the future.
And you were telling us earlier that some parents have actually had to quit school or quit jobs. Why is that?
Well, what we have done is we have some child care partners in the community that we could place them with. They don't get the exact same services in those, but we do have quality child care here in Salina. But these parents who have had to change their plans have had to do that because they didn't qualify anymore for full-year care because we had to change the requirements to serve as many families as we could. Mm. And so some of them have had to completely alter their life to make sure that they have at least a few hours of care a day for their child.
Claudia, it's been reported that at least two programs in Indiana resorted to a lottery to determine which 36 preschool students would be dropped immediately. And there were reports from the local papers about people just weeping when this information was announced. Do you happen to know if that's unique or is that happening in other places?
Well, the National Head Start Association, which is the advocacy group for grantees and for families and programs, says it doesn't know exactly how many jobs, how many kids have been cut, but these are becoming more and more widespread. I don't know how many lotteries there have been, but I do know that Coleman, Texas, for example, shut down entirely. And there are programs, Owensboro, Kentucky, for example, last Friday, fired over 40 staff. I mean, this is happening everywhere. And depending on how resourceful some of these centers are, some are finding ways to cut so that, you know, they don't have to cut kids. But most centers are laying off staff. That's just one of the things that they've had to do.
Tabitha, can you tell us a bit more about what experience the kids have at Head Start? And you were saying it's not just daycare. I mean, there are some people who say, well, you know, this is daycare. Tell us a little bit more about the kinds of experiences that kids have in Head Start and why you think this matters.
Well, the children are here when I get here every day. We eat meals together. We talk about our home family and our school family. What we saw on the way to school, that's a place where we teach math and language and problem solve and practice self-help skills. They're really a part of our school family. That's what you become when you come to Head Start. We work so closely with their home family that it's like we're all really related. We take care of our classroom together. We work on building positive relationships. We don't just play outside at recess. We have an outdoor classroom. We take our kids on a field trip every month and build partnerships in the community. Every minute the children with us is a learning time. And we focus on school readiness goals that if they didn't have, they wouldn't be ready for kindergarten. This sequester has sort of put a hole in the lives of those children and the families because we provide classes for the families as well on relationships, healthy cooking, parenting, financial responsibility, English language learning. Mm. And, you know, the kids every day, people who are my friend on Facebook always just die when they hear the things my kids say. One student said to me, you know, Miss Tabitha, what I like the most about you. And I said, what was that? And he said, your heart. Mm-hmm. And that's what Head Start gives to the children and the families. They give their heart. They give their whole life.
Before I let you go, Tabitha, you're too modest to mention this, but I understand that your salary was also cut?
Yes, my salary was also cut.
By how much?
$13,000 a year.
And that's what, a third?
That's a third of what I made.
Mm-hmm. That's hard. Claudio, before we let you go, what are you hearing from around the country about this? I mean, how significant do you think that this is, and what are advocates saying?
Tabitha, this is, and I was about to refer to Tabitha's situation. I mean, this is typical, and it is so serious. It's mind-boggling that, you know, the federal government has restored some funding for the airlines, let's say, for air travelers not to be inconvenienced because of the sequester. And yet, when it comes to these children, to these families, to these workers, it's amazing that they're essentially, you know, I mean, they're not going to recover. They're not going to recover these funds.
Why, Claudia, just before we let you go, we have about a minute left. Tell me again what the experts say about why they feel this kind of early childhood exposure is important.
Well, it's important because the science says that the earlier you get to these kids, the better off they're going to be academically down the road. And there's been no dispute about that. One big question that I'm also hearing is whether the president's 2014 budget is going to make up for this. According to what we've seen, 1.9% is going to be restored, but that's still going to leave a huge hole in the Head Start budget as we know it.
Claudio Sanchez is NPR's education correspondent. He was kind enough to join us in our Washington, D.C. studio, as he does from time to time, to keep us up to date on important issues in education. Tabitha McMullen is a Head Start teacher. She joined us from Salina, Kansas. Tabitha, thank you so much for joining us. Thank you for your hard work.
Thank you.
Claudio, thank you.
You're welcome.
It turns out that the budget cuts that are affecting Head Start come at a time when spending on early childhood education is shrinking across the country. From 2011 to 2012, state funding for pre-kindergarten dropped by $500 million. That, according to a recent report from the National Institute for Early Education Research at Rutgers University. The director of that institute, Steve Barnett, is with us now. Welcome to you. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you. Happy to be here.
Now, Steve, your group found that funding for early childhood education or for early education has gone down by $1,000 per child in the last decade. So that trend would have started before these specific budget cuts that we're talking about, the sequester budget cuts. So what's behind that trend? Why is this happening?
Well, I think there are two things behind the trend. First, long-term, a tendency to favor enrollments over quality and not putting enough money in to keep quality going. And second, the Great Recession really devastated state revenues, and early childhood education is much more discretionary than other programs. It took a heavier hit. So over $500 of that $1,000 decline was in the last year.
Hmm. What, from a practical perspective, do you have a picture of what this looks like? Fewer hours of operation, fewer students, fewer supervisors. What's it look like on the ground?
Well, all of those things. So fewer students enrolled. If you look across Head Start, state-funded pre-K, local programs, before the sequester, enrollment was already down at the very time eligibility was up because of the recession. And then programs had to make cuts in quality. So class sizes were larger, teacher salaries were cut, length of the year might have been shorter. Some programs probably moved from full day to half day. At the state level, capacity to monitor program quality, evaluate, work on continuous improvement, that actually got cut first and hardest.
You know, in your research, you found that not all states were actually cutting funding. Some states are actually increasing funding. Can you talk about that?
Absolutely. Most states cut funding, but some states moved in the other direction. Wisconsin's an example of a state that added 5,000 new slots for preschoolers during the recession. Right now, Governor Patrick in Massachusetts and Governor Snyder in Michigan have both proposed massive multi-year increases in preschool, really bucking the trend. And a number of other states, Alabama is an example of a state that is pushing forward with modest increases despite difficult times.
Can you talk a little bit about the, if you feel comfortable doing this, I'm interested in sort of the politics of this. I mean, there are some issues in which there is a clear philosophical divide around certain policies. Some people think that certain things are important. Some people think that they're not. Is there a philosophical divide around this issue, or is there simply states looking for places to save money?
Well, I find there's an informational divide because it's not a partisan issue. It's not a conservative-liberal issue. You have a Republican in Michigan and a Democrat in Massachusetts at the same time proposing big increases despite tight budgets, and they've done that by prioritizing preschool. But I think some places just see it as – some people just see it as babysitting. They do not understand, as we heard in the last segment, that this is an important part of a child's education. It's important for ensuring the kids are successful in school. Legislators, governors that understand that make it a high priority. Those that don't understand that and think it's just high-priced babysitting, they see it as a place to cut.
I'm going to bring our education correspondent Claudio Sanchez back in with us. He's here with us for this part of our conversation as well. Claudio, thanks for staying with us.
You bet. I have a question about, you know, the politics of this. The president has really made a big deal about putting together $75 billion over 10 years so that You know, states can expand preschool opportunities for kids, especially poor kids. The question is, of course, whether Congress is going to fund this over 10 years. But it does show that, and the president has said this, that 38 states at the very least are very interested and concerned about the impact that cutting out or reducing opportunities for kids is going to have long term on their educational systems. Mm-hmm. And I'm just wondering whether the research at Rutgers has pointed to what the long term impact of having such a measly amount of money right now in the states going towards preschool education is going to mean in the long term, in the middle of this whole debate over quality of education K through 12.
Steve, what about that?
Well, I think that's a great question. The benefits that everyone talks about, the 7-to-1 return that the president talked about in State of the Union, is really avoiding the costs of failure that we're already paying. So if you look where the benefits come from, they're really cost savings because we're correcting problems that we have now from not investing enough. When children in many urban communities start 18 months behind at kindergarten, that sets them on a path to school failure. They're going to repeat grades. They'll need special education that they could otherwise do fine without. They're more likely to drop out of school. They're more likely to get involved in crime. If we look at what costs us money, the criminal justice system is a huge expense. Some states are now spending more on prisons than they are in higher education.
I'm not sure which of you wants to answer this question. What is it about early education that is so powerful and that has such significant long-term effects? You know, why is that? Claudia, do you want to answer that? What is it that people have found that makes this such an important part of life? Because I think there are a lot of people who will say, I didn't go to pre-K.
Well,
what's the big deal?
Michelle, I think it has a lot to do with how we've raised the standards and expectations of children academically. It used to be that in kindergarten, it was all about play. Schools weren't asking kids to know their colors. They're counting from 1 to 10 or to 20 or whatever. The expectations of children today academically are much, much higher. And so the expectation of children before they start school have to be higher. And we all know that really, really good programs do teach those things, do prepare those kids so that they hit the ground running. When those things don't happen, that's when we see this endemic problem of kids not being prepared and never catching up, so that by third, fourth grade, their reading skills are below par, and it's even harder for them to catch up after that.
Steve Barnett, thanks so much for joining us. Steve Barnett is the director of the National Institute for Early Childhood Research at Rutgers University. He joined us from their studios there. Steve, I hope you'll keep us up to date on this important research.
My pleasure.
Claudio Sanchez is NPR's education correspondent. He was kind enough to join us in our Washington, D.C. studios. Claudio, thank you so much
for
joining
us. Good to be here.
I'm Michelle Martin, and this is Tell Me More from NPR News. And now we want to tell you about a TV and radio personality that you might love or love to hate, but whom you cannot ignore. She got her start in radio more than 20 years ago and quickly built a reputation as a personality who loved to push people's buttons and push the envelope, even with celebrities that other people fawned over or flattered. And she brought that personality to The Wendy Williams Show with Jay Butte in 2009. Here she is doing verbal karate with reality TV star Omarosa.
Wait.
What?
You said you was going to straighten me out. What the hell was that?
I said smooth you out.
Smooth me out. What does that mean?
We're talking. Have a nice conversation.
Let's have a conversation.
Omarosa.
Oh, no, I know how to chill.
Okay.
But I will not be disrespected.
Okay. This is not the time for you to look for your moment. I invited you here.
Oh, I know how to find my moment.
I understand.
Moments like this first put Wendy Williams into the National Radio Hall of Fame and now have made her daytime television program, The Wendy Williams Show, one of the most popular programs in daytime, and have given her a platform to talk about everything from her fashion choices to her own past, including some battles with addiction. Having put her hand to fiction previously, Wendy Williams is also giving advice now. She's just written a book. It's called Ask Wendy, and she is with us now. Diva, welcome. Or actually, what I really want to say is, how you doing?
How you doing?
Which is one of your catchphrases, right?
It is probably my most infamous catchphrase. How you doing?
How are you doing?
I am doing really well. I'm very busy, and busy is good. This is the life that I dreamt of living.
Well, I wanted to ask you about that. How come? Why is this the life you dreamt of living? What gave you the vision to do what you're doing?
Well, I didn't grow up with a trust fund. I grew up in a working class household in New Jersey, and I knew that my future after high school was that I owed my parents 4 years of college. They did not have a penny more than 4 years, so I knew that I had to get out here because nobody was going to hand me anything.
What is it that you were hoping to do when you grew up?
I wanted to be either a newscaster or a radio personality. Growing up in New Jersey, a suburb of New York, that part of Jersey that I grew up, I'm 48 years old. I'll be 49 in July. I grew up in an era where dinner was served at 5 o'clock. TVs had rabbit ears. You know, I was around when the first remote control TV, was invented. And I did not have a TV in my bedroom as a child. And radio was my source of entertainment in my room when I went into Wendy's world. And everybody just sounded so cool and just sounded like such a glamorous life. And then regarding the news, we were forced to watch the news because that's what my mom and dad watched on only one of two TVs in the house. Of course, there were and still are tons of images for little, white kids to grow up and look at and see as attainable. But as a black girl, seeing, Sue Simmons and Chi Chi Williams and Vic Miles do the news, I said, I want to do that.
The thing about your style, though, for people who have not experienced the Wendy Williams experience, is that, let me just put it the way I would put it, you can tell me how you would put it, is that you say things to people that often people think, but they don't say.
Well, I've always had to, because I come from the left side of society. You never stray far from the fiber that makes you, Michelle. And the fiber of who I am was I grew up a fat kid, an average student at best, older sister, an A and B student, a dilettante, perfect, body type. My younger brother, well, he's the boy. Boys can never do any wrong. So I was the middle child. I was also only one of four blacks in my graduating class. I've never been to a prom. I always thought a lot, but kept it in my head and swore that once I escaped Ocean Township, New Jersey, that I was going to make something of myself and make my mark on the world. Until then, when I was young, trying to fight my way for attention, I always had to say it right away, talk a little louder, and say it immediately before I got cut off by the popular girl or the pretty girl or my smart sister or, the more fabulous person in the class.
Well, just to give people a sense of it who aren't familiar with this, one of the interviews that you're most known for is a conversation that you had with singer Whitney Houston back in 2003. This was before your television show. This was for the Wendy Williams Experience, your radio program. Let me just play it, and here it is.
So, Whitney, as far as you stand with drug use, is there drug use going on at this present time?
Who are you talking to?
To you, Whitney. You.
No, you're not talking to me. I'm a mother. Only my mother has privy to that information. You talk to your child about that. Don't ask me no questions like I'm a child.
I was a full-blown cocaine addict. So
problem, not mine. Move on.
Well, that was my problem, Whitney.
You helped yourself. Did you ask God to help you?
And no, I managed, thank God, because I have a good man.
That was a very controversial moment for you. On the one hand, though, you were obviously onto something. So talk to me about that, if you would. First of all, is it part of your feeling that people shouldn't come if they're not ready to come correct?
Well, first, I just want to say that conversation was not done in a mean-spirited way. I mean, it obviously took a left turn based on the dearly departed Whitney's tone, and certainly we all have learned since then that I was onto something, and I knew it at that particular time. But Listen, I always feel that straight talk makes for straight understanding, and this has nothing to do with the Whitney interview. This is just more of my interview style. When I come to an interview, I am pretty much an open book. If you ask me something that I wasn't comfortable answering, it wouldn't be about me swinging my neck and raising my voice. I would say to you politely, you know, I'd prefer not to talk about that now, Michelle. And that's all.
Well, why do you think it is that it's on the one hand, people, you're not, nobody's under subpoena. I mean, nobody has to come and talk to you.
Right.
But they do, and then they're mad. And so I'm just, what do you think that is?
Because my audience has always been filled with the tastemakers. And that's ultimately it. I mean, you might get the sense, you might, you know, sense something from me that maybe rubs you the wrong way. But if you look at my audience, they're the ones buying your music. They're the ones buying tickets to the matinee to see you. I also get the sense these days that people, including celebrity to celebrity, celebrities so much want to be in the company of other celebrities. They want to be at the, they want to be invited to your five-star wedding in Bora Bora. They want to be at your kid's christening. They want to be at your big New Year's Eve party. I am not one of those people. Every fiber of me is just a girl from New Jersey who happened to have made it big. Because of my career and because I know how things can be spun horribly out of control with celebrities, I prefer to stay in the house. And I prefer to stay in Jersey. The gossips will talk anyway, and people make stories and so on and so forth. And I've learned that being on both sides of the track. But my interview style, my approach to celebrity is I am one of you. I am not one of them.
Mm. Do you think that, and if you're just joining us, we're speaking with television talk show host Wendy Williams, one of the most popular hosts in daytime. We're talking about her career and also her new book when we get to that. It's one of the interesting things about being an African-American in the media, interviewing other African-American stars, is that there's been a kind of a tradition in the black media of
we don't
enhancing.
Talk about one another.
Well, make it, yeah, making and making people look good, you know, enhancing.
Yeah.
Like the not to take anything away from Ebony Magazine's journalism, but the tradition was not to talk ill of people, not to take them, not to shine a negative light on anybody because the feeling was that the mainstream media is for that. And
yes.
I kind of wonder whether you feel that you are either a reaction to that, or is it taking them down a peg, or what do you think?
It is a heavy burden on the shoulders of black people in the public eye. We don't have enough of us out here in the public eye to have that luxury of doing wrong. The Obamas are in the White House, but that's not enough. I'm a black girl from Jersey, and being black in the media, I consider myself part of the mainstream. Yes, I am black. I acknowledge my black all day long, my black husband, my black son, my black parents, blacky, black, black, and I eat pork, and I love fried chicken. But with that said, everybody is talking hot topics these days. So for me to leave off the story about LL Cool J would be hypocritical. But I'm talking about Lindsay Lohan. It's a delicate line to walk, but it is what it is. We're in 2013.
Hmm. But as that clip, when the infamous Whitney-Wendy exchange, also you were also not shy about disclosing that you've had your own problems.
There you go.
Including a cocaine addiction.
Well, that was my problem.
Yeah.
I mean, I wasn't addicted to alcohol or weed or pills or anything like that. I was addicted to cocaine. Crack cocaine, cooking it, getting it up in the Bronx. This is before cell phones, waiting, just like a real fiend, waiting on Jerome Avenue, 3 o'clock in the morning as a single woman with a thriving career here in New York. Thank God I never got stopped by the cops to shame my family and myself and lose my job. Thank God I never got raped, robbed, or killed in an alley. Thank God my heart never palpitate to the point where I was dead in my apartment. So I don't mind outing myself.
Why did you?
Because I think it's important to share. And I particularly think it's important to share in our black community. You know, it's important to share with everybody. But we as a people, we've got a hard time sending Uncle Cecil, who's been an alcoholic for all his life, to alcohol rehab. Instead, we will just prop him up on the couch at Thanksgiving and keep feeding him his Chivas Regal. That's not right.
You know, well, to that end, your latest book, and I mentioned you have others, too. You've got a number of novels, and you've got you're also the author of the New York Times bestseller, The Wendy Williams Experience, a number of novels. But this is your first advice book, correct? I mean,
yes.
Well, actually, I could make an argument that your advice is kind of embedded in a lot of what you're doing anyway. I would make that argument. But this is your first, like, what gave you the idea for this?
It was a no-brainer. Ask Wendy is something that I had been doing on my radio show for years. I devoted a full hour, you know, in between songs. I would take telephone calls and people would come to me with their advice. And I find that the older I have gotten, the more people come with even deeper questions. And the more I've revealed about myself, the more people are not shy to reveal of themselves. The questions that I get right there on the talk show are fabulous. I love Ask Wendy. And to me, there's no question off limits. The idea of doing the book was a no-brainer because I only have about 2 minutes to answer your question on the show. And when people ask you advice, they need more than 2 minutes. And I also need to explain my answer so that you don't walk away thinking that I am crazy. This book is based on letters you've written me. So they're letters you write me. For instance, here's one. Dear Wendy, my fiance and his friend like to smoke pot and do it whenever they hang out, which is every weekend. He says it's fun, but I'm worried he's got a problem. Well, if you're going to ask Wendy, I'm going to give it to you straight. And then at the end of each chapter, what I do is I give you a few tips on how to avoid. Now, I don't know it all. You know, I'm a mess myself, admittedly so. But I feel secretly, like the Magic 8 Ball says, you know the answer to your problem. The answer lies within. I'm just flattered that I'm part of your council. Because I know that I'm not the only one you're asking for advice.
I feel you. Yeah.
I am part of your council, and I'm flattered. Look at this. Look, dear Wendy, my husband is always commenting on how hot the babysitter is. Should I be worried? You know what I told her? Yes, and you should also fire the babysitter. And I go on and on and on and on.
So was this fun? Was this a fun project for you, doing this book?
It was fun. Oh, my gosh. It was so much fun. And the book on tape was even better because I had to read every page and relive it. When I was reading the letters for this book, I laughed and I cried. I called my mother and father for counsel to make sure that I was, you know, just to get a second opinion. Ultimately speaking, I always gave my answers. I didn't care what they said, but they were both my counsel. You know, my dad is 83. My mom is 78, but they're very spicy and they're totally with it. And I would also ask my husband a couple of things or two. But if you were to hear me read these letters out loud, you would think I was a lunatic because honestly, they brought out the best and worst of my emotions.
Well, you are gathering no moss. You are taking on yet another project next. I understand that you are joining. Is this public? You're joining the cast of Chicago.
Yes!
And you're not excited about it at all. To play the role of Mama Morton.
Yes!
What made you decide to do that?
Hello? Who doesn't say yes when Broadway calls? I mean, it took me no time at all. Just like when Dancing with the Stars called. Now, while I wasn't the best dancer, who says no when Dancing with the Stars called? It was a wonderful opportunity. Now, it's no secret. I am not a singer.
I was going to say, can you sing?
I can't sing and I can't dance. but what I can do is I can be sassy and I am full of energy. So I can report on time every night and do it.
And you are not lacking in confidence.
Well, here's the thing. I can't wait to multitask. I'm going to be working with a vocal coach. I think I go in with vocal next week. It's not to learn how to sing because you can't just all of a sudden learn that. It's going to learn how to pace my pipes so that I can sing at night and chat hot topics and ask Wendy and talk show during the day.
Well, I feel very flattered that you gave up some of your vocal capacity for us. So thank you for that.
It's a very exciting time. I mean, you know, between the talk show, the Broadway. I love doing the talk show. And I have my wig line. You know, I wear wigs all the time. It's coming out in July.
Yes, we do. We do know you. Which wig are you wearing right now? Your fondness for wigs is something that you are very clear about. You said you had a wig. I heard you say to Jimmy Fallon that you have a wig to get your mail.
A wig for every occasion. Well, the one that I'm wearing now, this is called Center Part Street Wig with a Beachy Feel. It you know, I wear wigs. Now, I make jokes about it. I have a disease, thyroid disease. I was diagnosed 14 years ago, and I've been wearing a wig every day for my life for about the past 11 years. I do have hair. It's just too thin. If I had a smaller personality and a smaller physique, this hair would be fine. But my hair is I look like a snowman with my little tiny hair. You know, everything gets bigger as it goes down. So I wear a wig out of necessity, but I've turned it into something fun, which is how I was raised. Turn lemons into lemonade. Stop feeling sorry for yourself. Get up and keep moving.
Do you have any wisdom you want to share while we're at it?
Live big. On your own terms.
Wendy Williams is host of her own daytime talk program, The Wendy Williams Show. As she mentioned, she will be starring or joining in the cast of Chicago on Broadway this summer. And she was kind enough to join us from our bureau in New York. Wendy Williams, diva, thank you for joining us.
Michelle, one question for you.
Yes, ma'am.
How you doing?
And that's our program for today. I'm Michelle Martin, and this is Tell Me More from NPR News. Let's talk more tomorrow.